We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, May 30th, and that means that we are one day into the deliberations in Trump's Manhattan criminal trial. And if you see the headlines and you turn on any of the news channels, you would think that this is literally the only story in the world right now. Politico yesterday in Politico Playbook PM, which Politico Playbook is followed by a lot of the DC insiders. And of course, you know, I read that along with everything else. And they now have a verdict watch. And Fox News had a couple of reporters that were sitting outside in their little pop-up tent and saying, you know, we're on verdict watch, as if, I mean, it's like they want to see the the white or black smoke or whatever that comes out of the Vatican when they've selected the new pope. I mean, it's just beyond anything in the court of public opinion that has ever occurred. And I think, and I was thinking about this, and obviously this is a big deal. It's a big deal for the justice system. It's a big deal for America's institutions. It's a big deal for Trump himself. It's a big deal for America. It will have implications for the election. Either way, if there's a full acquittal, if there is a guilty verdict, if there's a hung jury, I mean, all of these things are very important in numerous ways. But in listening to some of the commentary yesterday, just from, you know, some of these leftists, it's become so dramatically apparent. I mean, if it wasn't earlier, it's just become so apparent that all that they care about is just having a guilty verdict for something. And it should never be that we want to get our political opponents regardless. And as long as there is a guilty verdict, it literally doesn't matter what the substance is. It doesn't matter if it's a fair trial. It doesn't matter, according to the judge's jury instructions, even if the jury is unanimous, which is another crazy aspect of this that we're going to talk about. All that matters is that in the court of public opinion and on the campaign trail, they can call Trump a convicted felon. And it's just a really dark day in American jurisprudential history, because we should be better than that in terms of our institutions and in terms of our politics. And I think that our discourse and our American institutions and the way that we are moving forward, or backward, as the case may be, in American history and in the ways that we are conducting ourselves are really troubling. And so this isn't just about the, you know, the hush money. It's not just about what the case is supposedly about. The real issue is whether or not the left will prevail in their strategy to take down their political opponent for 2024. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again, and I know that some people, you know, in our audience disagree, and that's fine. But I think that it would have been so much wiser for the GOP if we had just taken that entire card or ammunition off the table for the left and simply nominated someone else, and then defend Trump against all of the weaponization of government. Don't defend him on things he doesn't deserve defending. And there's plenty of criticism, and we should, as conservatives, do that, and particularly as Christians. But just we should have just taken that arrow out of their quiver and said, you know what, we'll deal with all of that, but let's just ignore this entire effort and we will nominate somebody else. That would have changed their entire strategy and their entire ballgame. And I think ultimately for those who are really concerned about Trump, that would have also changed their strategy. They wouldn't have been so eager to take this to trial right away. They wouldn't have been so eager to have, you know, the Trump verdict watch. I mean, it would have been a former president who is staying former instead of being so ever present in the media's mind and would not have nearly the implications that it would for the 2024 election. It still would on things like presidential immunity, all of that kind of stuff. You know, the ballot case, that was a big deal. I mean, Trump is testing and the left are testing the bounds and the contours of the law and the Constitution in ways that have never been tried in American history. But I just think it would have been a lot wiser and savvy for us as conservatives to maybe think about playing a different game instead of the one that they wanted everyone in America and they wanted all of us to participate in. But let's talk about, you know, what's going on in the case itself. And joining me is a very good friend, Ron Coleman, who is an attorney out of California. He is a member of the Dillon Law Group, Harmeet Dillon, who's a good friend as well, and hosts the great podcast Coleman Nation. And Ron, I want to play this clip and then get your initial reaction because, you know, the jury instructions that were given yesterday. So we are into day two of deliberation. Everybody thinks this is somehow totally crazy that, like, oh man, it's day two. Well, yeah, there's 34 counts. There's a lot of evidence. This was a 5-week trial. We're not just going to get a political knee-jerk rapid response. But Andy McCarthy and Bill Himmer on Fox News yesterday were talking about what Jonathan Turley, who is an attorney, was saying, and Jonathan Turley is apparently sitting in the courtroom, so isn't able to be on TV live, but was giving Fox some of his thoughts from the courtroom. And so this is what they had to say about the jury instructions. This is cut five.
What Turley wrote is the following. Judge Merchan has even ruled that the jurors can disagree on what actually occurred in terms of the second crime. This means there could be three groups of four jurors, with one believing that there was a conspiracy to conceal a state election violation, another believing there was a federal election violation, which Bragg cannot enforce, and a third believing there was a tax violation, respectively. Nonetheless, Merchan will treat that as a unanimous verdict, he concludes. In other words, they could look at the indictment and see vastly different shapes, but still send Trump to prison on their interpretations. Is that the way it works, Andy?
No, it's not, and it's really... It would be a constitutional outrage in any case, Bill, because juries have to find unanimously, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the prosecution has proved all of the elements of the case. So the idea that they don't have to agree on something that essential in any case would be outrageous. But considering the historic nature of this case, and also considering, and I think this is very important, the other crime is what turns this from a misdemeanor on which the statute of limitations has run to a 4-year felony that has a 6-year statute of limitations, which is why we're all here. That crime has to be one that everybody agrees on. It's outrageous that they don't have to agree on that.
So, Ron Coleman, you're an attorney. You've taken many cases, trial, deliberated over, and litigated a lot of jury instructions. Your thoughts on this, and good morning.
Well, everything, how are you doing, Jenna? Everything you just heard is absolutely correct. I mean, it is, we're really past, we passed a long time ago, but these jury instructions were the final nail in the coffin of the sustainability of any possible conviction here. It is absolutely shameful. And as you say, it's simply a political, it's a political witch hunt. We've been saying this for more than many months now. And Merchan does not seem to be the least bit embarrassed or concerned about the way his actions are perceived by lawyers, by legal scholars. He has a job to do. He knows what it is. And the New York court system has aligned in a way to let him do it, at least at this level.
Yeah, which is really scary, to be honest. I mean, this evokes thoughts and imagery of, you know, the prior star chambers that, in history that were really just these forums that were not about pursuing fact-finding, truth-finding, and verdicts that were based on fact and law, but rather just political persecutions and in a Trumpian word, you know, rigged. And as you and I have talked about before, I mean, there is a hopeful sense that any conviction may be overturned on appeal, but we're not at that stage yet. And so as we're going through the deliberations of the jury and everyone is waiting, and it's up to the jury. I mean, it may take them through this afternoon. It may take them another 2 weeks. I mean, that's just entirely up to them. But what impact... Right. Does this particular jury instruction have when you have a case, and I want to make sure that listeners understand this, like you have a case where to get to the felony, the prosecution has to prove that there was an underlying crime that then the falsification of business records was an attempt to cover up that crime. But the jury now the prosecution hasn't told us what that underlying crime is. They haven't told even the defense. And now the jury doesn't have to even be unanimous on which of the falsifying of business records. I mean, is that really what the jury instructions are saying? Like that you don't have to have unanimity on any aspect of this?
Well, I think everyone agrees that that's what the jury instructions say. I just think I think that he's really so profoundly overplayed his hand that he's really undermined any shred of respectability or credibility that this process has. You're right that at this juncture, the involvement of an appellate court is not going to help. They desperately want to be able to say a jury convicted. But it's entirely possible, and a lot of people have speculated along these lines, that there are enough well-intentioned and well-educated jurors, and the jury does include a couple of lawyers, that they can see just what a train wreck this is. And at the very least will hold out, whether they're able to convince their fellow jurors to acquit. It's a mess. It's a mess, and these are New York jurors. That means that, yes, they're overwhelmingly likely to be personally liberal, but they're not brain damaged.
We hope. No, I don't know. They still live in New York, so they're still choosing to live in New York. So I don't know if we can go that far, but yes,
Fair enough.
Hopefully they are reasonable. You're right, and I think that's really fascinating that there are a couple of lawyers on the jury, because you would think that the Trump team would want that for sure, to see through kind of this, you know, this mist of ridiculousness. But the fact that the prosecution is okay with that, I think, is really fascinating. And this all goes back. Go ahead.
They can't stop themselves. They can't stop themselves. They can't help themselves. I mean, remember, this was the prosecution that even Bragg, who is a hack, couldn't bring himself to proceed with until the screws got turned on him, by every indication. That's how bad it is. They cannot stop themselves. They're like drug addicts or alcoholics.
Yeah, and we got to take a break here, but I will hold Ron Coleman over into the next segment so that we can break this down a little further, because there's a lot to discuss that I find you know, as a trial lawyer, I mean, I've taken many cases to verdict on both sides as a prosecutor and as a defense attorney. And, you know, there's so much that's fascinating about juries, about the process, all of this, you know, beyond just obviously the weaponization and the political stuff. But we will talk more about it right after this when we come right back here on American Family Radio Network. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And if you're just joining us, we are talking about the Trump verdict watch, which is the top story in the country today. And there's so much else that is going on. But of course, the left and doesn't want to talk about any of, you know, the economy, inflation, or the open border, or, you know, any of these other topics that are actually really important to the country. It's all about just being able to say that a jury of his peers convicted Donald Trump. That's really what they are after. And so I'm joined by Ron Coleman, who is an attorney and part of the Dillon Law Group and the host of the fabulous podcast Coleman Nation. And before the break, Ron, we were talking about the composition of the jury and that there are actually, you know, reportedly a couple of lawyers on the jury. And I find that part of it really fascinating. And, you know, the jury is usually, at least in reports and as journalists cover these sorts of things in trials, the jury is the focal point at the beginning during voir dire and jury selection. And then, of course, at the end when they are deliberating. And then, you know, everybody sort of focuses on the evidence, the witnesses, the testimony and stuff in the middle. But at least the way that, you know, I was raised as a lawyer and doing trial work, if you're competent and you are good, you are thinking about your closing argument and everything that you do during the trial, including jury selection, is all about the closing argument. And so what is your thought here? And, you know, we haven't been able to see this trial on TV, so we're just getting reports, and there's a ton of speculation about, you know, looks and nods and winks and, you know, other things, kind of reading the tea leaves of the jury that, you know, are just total speculation. But in terms of what we know, what does it indicate to you, you know, someone who's also, you know, done and far more trials and so forth than I have, that the jury came back yesterday and actually asked to re-review some of the evidence, which included some of these portions of testimony by, for example, David Pecker, who was the former publisher of the National Enquirer, who prosecutors say was part of this conspiracy to suppress the unflattering stories on Trump's behalf during the 2016 election. And also the jury also requested some related evidence related to the testimony by Michael Cohen. So, I mean, that to me indicates that they're not just making a quick decision based solely on their gut feeling without actually reviewing and considering the evidence.
Yeah, they're deliberating. I think this is not good news for the prosecution. Because the fact that questions are being asked and discussion is taking place and that people, someone is obviously engaged, and, you know, it's hard for me not to imagine a scenario where, you know, maybe one are saying, no, you guys, you're missing it. You're missing the whole point. And perhaps the disbelieving other people in the room are saying, how could you possibly say that? He says, listen, why don't you listen to what Pecker said? Listen to what Cohen said. Let's get a read back. I think a lot of people thought they would be in and out, that it was going to be rubber stamp, that it was going to be, listen, it's Trump. We know what our job is here. And as I said earlier, you know, even if they might be brain damaged in the self-preservation category, it's not a D.C. jury. It is going to be an interesting experience. Certainly, if they acquit, it will be a phenomenal event. But you know, Jenna, I think the main thing, and for people of faith, which is obviously a large part of your audience, this to me is a providential development. This entire the whole way that this has gone is really God pulling aside the curtain. I made a video on this yesterday, so that people can realize what has actually been going on in the courts for a very, very long time. And the reason that they're aware of it now is because it matters to a lot more people than the individual and anonymous parties who are flushed down the system and no one ever hears about it.
That's a really good point, Ron Coleman, that, you know, even some other high profile cases, like we think, you know, most recently of like Kyle Rittenhouse and Derek Chauvin, you know, with the George Floyd incident. I mean, some of those individuals were not known to the public until their trial. And so you're learning about them and their history and so forth, you know, during the trial. And those, of course, had political implications and overtones. But Trump is very different because everyone comes in with 100% name ID of the defendant and of the history. And so there's a lot more color and context here than you generally get. And one of the things that I think you and I certainly would agree with is that while we say broadly that the American justice system is, you know, the greatest in the world and look at, you know, all of the protections we have in the Constitution and so forth, as our founders would say, and Justice Scalia was so often correct in saying, it's just a parchment guarantee unless it's actually enforced. The protections of the Constitution, things like the right to the presumption of innocence, you know, the right to competent counsel. I mean, all of these things that go into due process, it's just a parchment guarantee unless it's actually enforced and it's applied and it plays out. And for so many people who go through the system on a daily basis, they don't get those guarantees and they are just pushed through with a very callous, unfortunately, system. And so, you know, how do you think that in this broader sense, and I would agree with you that, you know, providence, God ordains all things. And, you know, he knew before the foundation of the world that we would be sitting here in 2024 heading into this type of election, all of these things.
Right.
And so what is the overarching lesson that we should take away from this in terms of our institutions and how to best create a more perfect union going forward when we have all of these clear flaws?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to acknowledge that our institutions have failed. They have always depended on a level of trust and integrity. That level was never 100%, but it has always been fundamental to the endeavor. It's not there anymore, largely because people absolutely do not believe in right and wrong. They believe in power. It is a tragedy for democracy, but I do believe that politically, if someone or someone's wanted to grab the issue of criminal justice reform and civil justice reform, for that matter, the entire system has to be revisited, ought to be revisited, and I think that there would be a lot of public support for that.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, and I would hope that what would continue as well is civic engagement. I mean, I have liked to see, and it's a good thing that has come out of the Trump era, that because there has been a light that has shined so brightly into the dark recesses of the swamp and some of these corrupted institutions or the ways that they have been weaponized for power instead of virtue, that more people would become engaged in civics and that we would become more responsible in terms of our self-governance. Because we could be in another nation where, yeah, we're criticizing things and we see the flaws, but there's not much that the average citizen can do to affect change in their own government. But we can, and that's part of the blessings of liberty, of living in the United States. But it takes a lot more people than just, you know, one vote. It takes a collective, and that becomes very important when we consider how we create a more perfect union. And I would hope that as we move forward, it's just been so frustrating, Ron Coleman, to me to see the, even with all of this, the low level of political discourse that comes out of not just social media, but, you know, media and all of that in general, that instead of striving for some of these higher ideals, it's like we go to the lowest common denominator of the more baser, crass rhetoric, instead of talking about political philosophy and some of these ideals. And I would hope that at least in our churches and for people of faith, we can get back to some of that political philosophy that is built upon the Judeo-Christian worldview.
I agree 100%. I don't see how we redeem ourselves as a nation without a return to belief in God and in revealed truth. As set forth in the Bible, I simply don't see how it happens. And that means that those of us who do live in faith communities are obligated to conduct ourselves in a way that makes people ask, what can I do to raise a family, to be a person more like that family, more like that person, and hopefully to investigate the faith that they were raised in or that is right for them and that which represents biblical truth.
Yeah. And of course, you know, and the truth, you know, I think we can all agree there is objective truth and we need to seek that out. And we need to rightly divide truth from error. And certainly when it comes to doctrine, to things of God and to focus on raising families, raising the next generation to be good citizens. I mean, you know, all of these things, Ron Coleman, have vastly deeper implications than just the headlines, because when you look at even all the stuff that was going on the college campuses, the protests at Columbia and you know, in UCLA and across the country, and some of these young people that are just going along with all of this absolutely nonsensical conduct. And they're not even thinking through it, and they don't have the capacity, really, or at least the aptitude to think critically. They're just going along with the worldview as presented to them by whoever they follow, maybe on TikTok. I mean, who knows? We're seeing a generation by generation, a further devolution of a well-ordered society, because we are losing that central facet of morality. And so this criminal trial of Donald Trump is just one really big indicator of the overarching problem, that we are losing a sense of objective moral truth. And when we lose that, we lose meaningful justice. We lose meaningful virtue. We lose meaningful ways of conducting ourselves, even in the political realm or in some of these other elements like the protests. I mean, some of these things that should never occur. And so we have to get back to the truth. And I think that this starts with teaching that, because, you know, as Andrew Breitbart very famously said, you know, politics is downstream from culture. And if our culture and our institutions are captured, then it's no wonder that this criminal trial is occurring as probably a foreseeable consequence of rejecting God largely as a society.
Absolutely. You nailed it.
I try. But I mean, you know, so where, you know, where do the lawyers though go from here? I mean, you know, it's like not, we can talk kind of the big philosophy of all of this, but in each aspect of our own practice, our own vocations and all this, you know, where do you as a lawyer strive to say, okay, here's where I can make a difference when, and, you know, and you do a lot of First Amendment work, really good work. And yet there's only so much that one person can affect.
Well, I'm not the right person to ask because I've sacrificed a lot of my career to be, you know, to taking on unpopular causes, to speaking out, to being a public small p figure who is engaged in improving and trying to be an honest broker, notwithstanding that I have my own view of the matter. And yes, when you're a lawyer, you do have a certain amount of enhanced credibility, and if you've had some success, that helps a lot. Not everyone is going to be able to do that. Most people are concerned about their careers. But I say it all the time, if people will stop hiding behind anonymity, if people will be courageous and stand up for what they believe in a non-anonymous way, that will embolden others to find the courage to do what they have to do to stop the sort of things that we're seeing take place within the profession and within the institutions. It'll at least slow them down. It's if good men will be silent, then we are lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, Ron Coleman, that makes you a great person to ask, because I know that you have, you speak truth, that you've sacrificed a lot. And it takes people like that, that are willing to not pursue their career for their own sake, but to do good in society and to pursue the honorable and noble aspects of the profession. And, you know, and this is what drew me to the practice of law, and even beyond that, the philosophy of law, you know, the way that law moves in society and truly touches and concerns everything that we do. And it has to be fixed on a moral premise. Otherwise, it just becomes all about power. This is why law is so important for people to understand, and you know, and why also theology is so important for people to understand as well. Because no matter what you do in life, you should have a basic understanding, I think, of law, but you should have an enhanced and sufficient and robust understanding of theology. But thanks so much to Ron Coleman. You can always follow him on X on social media. He is almost as snarky as I am sometimes, so readers beware of, of that. But I love Ron. He's great. Always appreciate his insights. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Fostering and adoption is not a band-aid for infertility.
Nope,
like it is a calling, and God can change the desire of your heart and make that so rewarding. It's the most beautiful, selfless thing. It's pure religion, but it's not a fix to I desire biological child. God has to deal with that in your heart separately.
Hannah's Heart, encouraging couples through infertility and miscarriage. Saturdays, 4 a.m. Central on AFR or on the AFR app.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we've been talking about the Trump trial and the verdict watch and, you know, all of these things. And I think it is a very important to draw this out to kind of the 30,000-foot perspective, because this isn't just about the 2024 election. It's not just about whether or not, you know, Joe Biden can then run on, you know, Trump was convicted by a jury of his peers and, you know, all of the things that are right now in this moment in time. When we think about the broader concepts of justice, of virtue, of civil government, of how government is supposed to operate as an institution in a well-ordered civil society, we can then turn to this trial as an example of a miscarriage of justice, even just having the trial itself. I mean, there are so many times that prosecutors, unfortunately, will have a defendant sit through a trial or even through the pretrial process when it's totally unjustified and it's for political purposes, or it's simply because the prosecutor does not have the political will to deny the optics and the politics and dismiss the charges and not pursue them. Because ultimately the state, and we're talking about, you know, prosecutors always work on behalf of the government, whether it's on the state level, like in New York, or whether it's on the federal level, like U.S. Attorneys, Department of Justice, and all of that, their client is justice. And in fact, there is a rule in every state, the rules of professional responsibility that govern attorneys' conduct, that talk specifically about the higher integrity that is required of a prosecutor, because the resources of the state are vast compared to what an individual client, even someone like Donald Trump, may be able to pay for or use. And the state also has power unlike any ordinary citizen. So when you think about a civil case where it's a person or group of persons, what we would call a corporation, versus some other person or corporation in the civil realm, that is very different in terms of the potential risk to the defendant and the potential outcome than something like a criminal trial, because liberty is on the line. And we're seeing that very clearly when we have, you know, headlines that are suggesting that the Secret Service is now, you know, talking to Rikers Island and some of the other, you know, possibilities of looking at whether Trump would actually be incarcerated if he is convicted. Liberty is on the line. In any other court case, and there have been many, you know, many litigations that Donald Trump has been involved in throughout, you know, his entire career. But none of them have really concerned him all that much, right? Because it was all just about money at the end of the day in the civil realm. This one and criminal trials are a direct risk of liberty, the most valuable protection of government that government guarantees to the individual liberty, but can ultimately take that away for a time through due process. That's what's at risk in a criminal trial. So there is a higher virtue that's required of state prosecutors, and this is why our founders in our Bill of Rights, in the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, had more specific textual protections saying government you cannot, basically. Like, in case you were not clear, we do not give you this particular power. There are more protections for citizens in the context of a criminal trial than anything else in our Bill of Rights. And that is purposeful, because our founders understood very clearly, coming from the English system, and also being students of history, knowing where humanity had been, where other government regimes had been, versus what they wanted to do in a self-governing society, they still understood that while government is necessary, because people do commit crimes, there are wrongs that occur in civil society, and rightfully, and we as Christians would agree with this, the government should pursue and punish individuals for wrong behavior. And I don't just say bad. I mean, this is not something that should be up to just whatever statutory construct any given society designs to punish, like hate speech, for example, that we are so focused on now in America. That actually completely contradicts the understanding of freedom and liberty that our founders understood, and intentionally embedded into our Bill of Rights that we have the freedom of speech, and speech that you and I may find incredibly offensive. And of course, contrary to the biblical worldview, all of that speech, like, for example, anti-Semitism, I think it is one of the most vulgar, hateful, condemnation worthy types of aspects to have any hate for any other human being made in the image of God on the basis of their race, their family origin, their political origin, the color of their skin, their sex. I mean, any of those things. The biblical worldview understands that every human being is made in the image of God and has inherent dignity and worth. And in that sense, we all are co-inheritors of the kingdom of God, if we are Christians, but we have the opportunity to be, and we are all equal in that sense. It is only the false worldviews that get to sexism, racism, all of these other isms. I find that as a Christian, profoundly wrong. But does that mean that the government should have the power to punish speech that is offensive, even if we can say it's objectively offensive? Well, our founders didn't think so, and I agree with them, because I don't want to give the government power to pick and choose what speech is preferred and is allowed, because then the obvious conclusion of that is that you end up not just with speech that is prohibited, but you end up with speech that is compelled. And that's where we are rapidly going as an American society, with things like the preferred pronouns. We will force you to then engage in speech that you find offensive. We will force you to engage in speech that you find just simply wrong, to use someone's pronouns that are contrary to the sex that God created them, not just that was assigned at birth, but that God created them. So these are complicated issues, but it really boils down to what power of government is legitimate. And we see government is legitimate to punish actual wrongdoing, but how we as a society understand what is criminal and what is not criminal conduct, that's where we get the very, very difficult questions. And this is where we get into all of the policy arguments of saying, for example, do we punish criminally abortions? That's a legitimate question. Do we punish some of these, some of these other what Christians would rightly call sin? Do we punish the homosexual lifestyle criminally, right? And I think we have gone so far as a society to call even these types of discussions hate speech. And, and if there's anybody listening from, like Right Wing Watch or whatever, welcome. You're probably hearing some of this for the first time, but I'm sure they're offended going, how can you possibly even talk about potentially, criminalizing some of this other conduct? Because they are so used to liberty meaning libertine. And liberty meaning only, as Ron Coleman rightly said, power of government and whoever is in control of those offices versus actual virtue. And so why the code of professional conduct for lawyers and also for judges as well, that is a big deal, why that requires the higher duty of a state actor is because our founders understood how easy it would be to use the power of government to manipulate it for political or special interest purposes and use that in a way that ultimately was unethical or was coercive and against genuine liberty. And we as Christians have to rightly define liberty. It is not just freedom to do whatever we want in a libertine sense. That is actually how both the people on the far right, the capital L, Libertarian Party, like when we saw at their convention this last week, and their candidate that they selected, who is for all kinds of crazy LGBTQ agenda stuff and sterilization of children and all of this, that actually devolves into anarchy, versus the far, far left that also wants to manipulate the power of government to say you are free just to do whatever we tell you you can do, right? You are only free insofar as you will be coerced into using the proper pronouns or refraining from praying in public or on a football field, or you are free to have a cake baking business or a website design business so long as you also use that in the ways that government tells you you must. That's not genuine liberty. But we have flipped this idea of what liberty means on its head to say we can do all of the libertine social sexual sins, basically, without a measurable difference of what it actually means to be right and wrong. And so we have largely, and this is where societies then stop flourishing and start using and manipulating power in a way that ultimately is wrong, when we then manipulate what is prohibited by and punishable by a criminal code versus what is permissible and also what is coerced by government to just be a matter of political whim and political power versus an objective standard of the measurable difference between right and wrong, good and evil. And this is why our founders understood that it was so necessary to restrain the power of the state in criminal prosecutions so that it would not be manipulated. This is why due process absolutely matters. And this is why even the executive branch, which is the branch of the state and the federal government that prosecutes, it's not, you know, the judicial system, that's a co-equal separate branch. Judges are part of the judiciary. And the executive is where the state attorneys, the U.S. attorneys, are. And the chief executive of a state or of the federal government has reserved to them the power of pardon. Because if and when a prosecution goes totally off the rails, it's for whatever reason, whether it ends up being because of a rogue prosecutor or someone that's not pursuing the interests of justice, or whether it what was a judge that imposed too harsh of a sentence, or, you know, contrary to the protections, cruel and unusual punishment that are embedded textually in the Eighth Amendment. The power of pardon is the ultimate stopgap that you have the chief executive that is able to say, no, I grant clemency, or I commute a sentence, or I grant a full pardon. And our founders understood we needed some of these powers that could be used when all else fails. And so we have to understand as Christians and in pursuing a more perfect union, understanding what liberty is and understanding why our institutions of government, particularly the justice system overall, I'm not just talking about the judicial branch, but that contains the executive as well, why we have to have law that is predicated on objective standards. Because if we get away from that, it just becomes the political whim of whoever is in power. And you don't have things like proper notice. You don't have things like in Trump's case, where the defendant is even put on notice or given an opportunity of, you know, what is the crime? I mean, and then you have a judge that is saying, well, it doesn't even matter if the jury is unanimous in a criminal trial. I mean, you have a constitutional protection to a right to a jury of your peers, to due process, to proper notice. I mean, all of these things that are textually within the Constitution for the sole purpose that the government cannot abuse its power. And yet we're seeing in so many cases, and I think Ron Coleman was absolutely right, that Trump's case now is just a national huge story of how the power of government can be manipulated to political ends instead of being used for a proper purpose. So the solution, of course, is to restrain government. The solution is to say government has gone off the rails in these institutions and we have to call it back to its appropriate guardrails. And this is where I am an advocate for the Convention of States project, because the federal government is not going to restrain itself. A lot of these state governments, if they are blue states, most often, will not restrain themselves. I mean, these are Soros-funded DAs, right?
They will not restrain themselves. The only way to do this is if we have enough state legislatures that will come together and propose amendments to our federal constitution that will be enforced because our constitution is still the highest law of the land. And we have to do this and use the tools available that the founders gave us for when the Constitution is being ignored. We can right the ship, but I think that we are living currently on borrowed time in America. And if we don't act soon, well, it may end up being too late. Always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.